You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest today is Loudon Wainwright III, a songwriter and actor. He's been active since the late 60s. He's released about 30 albums, several of them live albums. I think I first heard of him through his association with Judd Apatow's comedy movies like Knocked Up, and he was a cast member in Undeclared. You're right now hearing The Swimming Song from its fourth album, Attempted Mustache, from 1973. We'll be discussing How Old Is 75 from his most recent album, 2022's Lifetime Achievement, then a live track, Road Ode, from 1993's Career Moves, and then we'll look all the way back to his second album, called Album 2, from 1972. The song is Be Careful, There's a Baby in the House. Finally, we'll listen to a song from the 2001 album Last Man on Earth called Missing You. I also refer a lot to his autobiography from 2017, Liner Notes, on Parents and Children, Exes and Excess, Death and Decay, and a few of my other favorite things. For more information, see lw3.com. For more information about this podcast, please see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And you can support the effort at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic, which will give you access to my episode notes, as well as a completely ad-free experience. Let's get going. I will play a little bit of The Swimming Song from Attempted Mustache, 1973, to draft people in. Not your biggest hit, but apparently, according to your audiobook, your biggest hit, The Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road, maybe a sore spot, maybe not the thing to emphasize. And besides, I don't know how many of my listeners were actually functioning and alive. And, you know, I was born in 71. So if I'm the median age.
Yeah, you have no memory of hearing either of those songs as a toddler.
Yes, but this was revived. I don't know. This is your most listened to song on Spotify right now. We're going to get pretty quickly to the new record, Lifetime Achievement 2022. How Old Is 75 was the song you picked. A nice little banjo waltz. Are you playing banjo on this? Or
I am, yeah.
What is your history with the banjo?
Well, like a lot of people my age, which is at this point 78, you know who Pete Seeger was.
Oh, sure.
Well, there was a famous book that he put out. It had a red cover. It was called How to Play the Five-String Banjo. And when the folk boom happened in the early 60s, I got a banjo and I learned a little bit about playing the banjo. The simplest thing to play it was actually called the basic strum. But when I started to spend time with Kate McGarrigle, the mother of my two oldest kids and my first wife, The Swimming Song has two banjos on it, one played by me and one played by Kate. Hanging out with Kate, it made me a better banjo player. So I've always given her credit for teaching me how to frail the banjo properly.
How old is 75? So old that you're hardly alive. It's a number that's weighty. In 5 years you'll be 80, poised way up there on the high diving board. Tell me, how old is 75? Mom made it to 74. Though we all thought she'd get a bit more. Time you get what you get, so why get upset? And we all want just a little bit more time than is. Mom made it to 74. My dad, he kicked at 62. Way too young, but then what can you do? When one's number is up, there is no prenup type agreement between God and you. My dad, he kicked at 62. and so we proceed to go hence. In the hope some of it made some sense, with our allotted amounts, what gets done is what counts. Was time wasted or was it well spent? Did ya do as you chose like you meant? I'm having a party this year. I'm inviting all those dear and near. I may need a lift if you get my drift, and I'm hoping you all will be here then. I'm having a party this year, but I know some of you won't be there. I suppose you could be anywhere, in the ether or soil, free from sorrow and toil. You'll be missed, but you won't really care anymore. I know some of you won't be there. Tell me, how old is 75? So old that you're barely alive. In 5 years I'll be 80. I will hear the fat lady belly flop, jackknife, swan dive, or a cannonball off of the high diving. Tell me, how old is 75?
Do you want to say anything now that we've heard the song about where you're at with this song? I understand this is your first album of wholly new originals in quite a while.
Well, mortality has been one of my favorite topics. I mean, the first line on my very first record, which I made in 1969, was in Delaware when I was younger. So I seem to have always thought about the passage of time and where it's all going. So at this point, it certainly is an exploration of, you know, I name check my parents and the age that they were when they died. It's a song about mortality, one of my favorite topics.
Which, of course, has affected many people that you know. Was there any thought, like, are there 10 verses of this somewhere? Or is this pretty much, you're presenting yourself, you're going through your parents, you're saying, I'm having a party this year. What has determined the arc of the story for this, do you recall?
Well, I don't really determine the arcs. Being a songwriter for all this time, 50 years or whatever it is, when I've got one, the analogy I've used is fishing. When I've got a song on the line, it just kind of comes through, and I don't understand it or can't really explain it other than what I just tried to do. Again, it's just talking about the mortal coil and the shuffle that goes along with it. I mean, I have another song on a record that I made, you know, 10 years ago called Somebody Else I Know Just Died. I mean, so. Again, I've been exploring this stuff for pretty much all the records.
I don't know. I just started hitting 50 recently. I had a couple songs, like, people I know my age are starting to die. Not commonly, but, you know, some non-zero percentage. So I wrote a couple songs that were, you know, had death. Like, it could happen anytime. I don't know. I could get cancer tomorrow. Very different than being sort of fascinated by suicide. You know, you have your suicide song. Their right. Early career, when you're, you know, I'm not seriously considering suicide, but I'm depressed a lot at age 20. The death songs seem to have a very different tenor.
Yeah, well, it's a great topic. Death and family are my two favorite topics. So the suicide song is a very early example of my obsession with this whole area.
just having listened to that this morning, it seems like politically the attitude towards suicide, maybe the way humor changes over time, what is considered offensive. I don't know. Is that something that would ever make it by your sensibilities into a current set?
Oh yeah. That's a song where I wouldn't worry about that. I wasn't even aware that it is politically incorrect to talk. Oh, I guess it triggers people.
I mean, it's just like, if you're feeling suicidal, go ahead. Which clearly in a jokey way.
Yeah, well, that's what I say in the song. What the hell, what the hell, what the heck? You know, if you want to break your neck or whatever the lyric is. But I don't sing that song much. I can't recall the last time I sing it, but it was featured in the set in the old days, certainly.
Any thought about the arrangement on this? I mean, now that you've established it's the death song and you got this diving board image, which allows you to, it's the high dive. And you know that you can launch into the stratosphere, and it seems like your string arranger, or how much are you directing the...
Or a cannonball off of a high diving board.
So is that Rob Moose on this?
Yeah, Rob Moose. Rob Moose is somebody that I've worked with on a couple of records. He's a younger fellow than both of us. He's a wonderful young arranger. We sent the song, you know, the voice and banjo version of the song to Rob. And we sent him the whole record and said, is there anything on here that you might like to work on? And he liked How Old Is 75. So he came up with the arrangement. As far as the diving board goes, that is a connection, interestingly enough. We keep coming back to the swimming song, the thing that you're starting the show with, because in the swimming song, I talk about jackknives and swan dives and cannonballs. How Old Is 75 and the swimming song are definitely heavily connected.
Yeah, do you find your songs speak to each other? I remember how delighted I was the first time, you know, hearing Sting. You know, in The Police, he'll quote a previous song. He'll like lift the whole thing verbatim. It's not just, you know, thematically they're talking to each other. But if you're building a corpus like this, I would imagine that there's a lot of like, okay, this is a similar theme that I've approached before. Maybe I'll sort of say something to the previous song.
Yeah, but again, it's not for me anyway. It's not a question of something that I set out to do. I kind of notice it after the fact. But yeah, I write about the same things. You know, there's nothing new under the sun when it comes to the stuff that I write about and how I deal with it in the songs.
Well, and musically, especially as a folky guy, I can see this is why I started with the banjo, because, you know, how many different finger picking patterns can you learn? How many, it would seem that after a while, being one guy and his guitar, that either you have to layer stuff or, oh, let's do ukulele on a song. Let's do banjo on a song. Let's somehow mix it up or alternate tunings. I don't know. Was there at least a point in which that sort of made you nervous and you felt like you had to transcend yourself? You know, I'm thinking maybe late 70s when the layers started going.
No, I like the banjo. I like the ukulele. And the ukulele has the extra benefit that it's extremely light and easy to transport. But, you know, some of my favorite, do you know who Ukulele Ike was?
No.
Cliff Edwards, most famously known for the guy who sings When You Wish Upon a Star in Pinocchio. He's a wonderful actor and singer, but he was also a crooner and a ukulele player. I mean, I'm nowhere near anyway his skill in terms of playing the instrument, but I love the ukulele and the banjo. So that's why I play them. Not particularly well, but it's serviceable.
Or, you know, you haul out piano for some songs. I guess
that's an instrument that I'm really crappy at. But yeah, and that gives me a chance to sit down too.
And so is that, you know, you're saying that you're catching these songs on a line. Is it, okay, I'm writing this on the piano or I'm writing this on the banjo. Like, was this, did you write lyrics to this first, or were you with a banjo in hand coming up with this rainbow connection sort of thing?
What happens generally is, I mean, most of the songs are performed and written on the guitar. Mm-hmm. But occasionally I'll think, this might sound good on the banjo or the ukulele, or I'll sit down at the piano. And the most recent recording of me playing the piano is a song of mine called In C. And it actually has a joke about C is my piano key. I say that in the song. And then I say, if I was playing the guitar, it would be G. So it actually, I'm very focused on the mundane and the particular.
Well, that's a way of getting a lot of specific details I'm actually thinking in this song, I'm not seeing, usually there's, you know, specific, let's describe things in the room around me or give names of particular places. This one seems like it sticks to the slightly more abstract, in the ether or soil, free from sorrow and toil, the poetic and abstract rather than the mundane. Although, I mean, talking about a prenup between God and you, so that's a nice image. You know, it's still a metaphor, but it has a mundane element. All right, this is not eliciting, oh, I know, this is this poem that I feel like I was inspired by. No, it's just coming out.
And it's that song that I caught that day. That's all it was. It's you just pull it into the boat and then fiddle with it a bit.
Well, let me play a little bit. I'll pick out a chunk from the instrumental. I was especially interested in that little call and response thing and have this single note thing responding. What, you know, what is the thought with the technique there?
No thought. They're just I just play the banjo and play it, you know. And then you go, oh, I like that. That's all it is, really. Nothing much is premeditated about the songs for me.
I mean, are you still, despite your many years dabbling in the banjo, do you still feel like it's your own limitations that pick out, oh, this is the thing my finger stumbled on, as opposed to this was in my head and I'm going to realize that? Because I, you know, it would have been easy enough just writing it sort of in one's head to continue the underlying thumb bass or something under that little bit rather than have it just spring out like that.
Well, that's what somebody else would do. Mm-hmm. My limitations as a guitar player, a ukulele player, a piano player, as long as we're focusing on them, do in a sense drive the machine. But I don't feel apologetic about it because I think the songs, as you mentioned, you know, it came out of this folk tradition where it's, what's the Harlan Howard quote about country music? Three songs and the truth. It just has to be simple.
Three chords and the truth. Yeah.
Three chords and the truth. That's all it is. You know, I mean, I admire all kinds of songwriters, but a lot of them don't even read music.
Sure. I say this as a rhythm guitarist who started on bass and like I have very definite limitations such that I feel like, oh, I'm using this strumming style again. I don't want to do that. Or I'm you know, using this finger picking thing again. Maybe I should just not finish this song. But you've written so many songs. I'm picturing you don't ever have that sort of blockage of.
No, what I do is I say, oh, I use this again. Oh, it's great. Okay, it's back.
Okay.
Here it is, me doing that again.
Well, and the because your lyrics are so articulated and literary and vivid, then that gets to be the individuator. It doesn't matter if it's the same two chords or whatever that you've done on 20 other songs, because this is a unique story that has not been told in exactly this way.
Yeah, I've always maintained or often said that you're often asked this question, which comes first, the lyrics or the music? For me, the music is like train tracks and the lyrics are like the train. It provides something for the writing of the words. Although some people say that they like the melodies that I write too, and I appreciate that also.
Sure. In terms of the orchestration on this, right? You could have done this entirely solo, but instead we have this gradually creeping in. Let's introduce the violin, then have two violins, and then we've got a whole orchestra. Yeah, can you walk me through the production process?
We just sent it to Rob Moose.
Oh, okay.
Back to us. And by we, I mean the guy who produced the record with me, a guy that I work with a lot called Dick Kinnett. Mm-hmm. Dick and I listened to it, and wow, that's great. That was the production process.
Okay, so this is even when there's just one violin, this is not David Mansfield, is he your normal violin player who plays elsewhere on this album? I was reading that on your website.
No, it was Rob. I think he plays all the instruments on the arrangement. There's a cello on the arrangement too, so I think he hired somebody to do that, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, because it really, I mean, I guess it's very much suggested by your, again, the high dive and the motion. So he had the full final vocal, right? Or not a scratch when he's adding his stuff.
I probably recorded the song on the banjo. I did it four times. We picked the take we liked the best, and then we sent it to Rob. And that's probably what he used to do the arrangement. We just mixed the two things together.
And are you always recording the main instrument and your voice at the same time, or are you just for tracking purposes, I'm going to play silent banjo and then I'm going to sing so you have a little more flexibility with the rhythm?
I very, very infrequently do that unless there's a, I'm trying to fix a mistake. Normally, I sit down in front of the microphones with the guitar, or the banjo, or the ukulele, and I just play the song in real time and best one, or the one that I like the best.
Okay, so that's always been, even in the 70s stuff.
Well, you know, different records have been done different ways. There's a record called Attempted Mustache, and that was with those Nashville, those heavy-duty Nashville cats, as they used to call them, you know, all of whom are mostly dead now, but these are the people that played on Blonde on Blonde and Leonard Cohen's record. The producer of Attempted Mustache was Bob Johnston. So we did that live in the room with the band. I mean, I was probably in a vocal booth, but I was playing the guitar. Generally speaking, with a few exceptions, it's pretty basic, my recording techniques.
Sure. So there's not been any song that you've had to, oh, I actually have to learn to play this while singing, right? Because I wrote it sort of separately, and now I have to, if I want to put it on a stage, I have to reconstruct something. It sounds like these are made for the stage, made for at least being able to sit in a room and convey this song.
That's exactly my driving. I write the songs to perform them. Mm-hmm. So I sit down, I spend some time on a song, I play it many, many times, and then I go out to some club or some room somewhere and I perform it for people. That's kind of the last litmus test to find out if it works, if it's funny where it should be funny, or funny where I didn't expect it to be funny either, or serious or offensive or whatever I happen to be going for. That's how I find the songs work. But then often I will go into a studio and record it. But that's more or less how it goes.
If there's a fuller arrangement, are you ever particularly involved in that? Or are you just more like, that's too much, that's too little, but otherwise, do your thing, Mr. Arranger?
Yeah, I mean, like in the case of Rob Moose, I mean, you know, we trust him and we said, do your thing. And then we said, we like your thing. But again, every record is different. I mean, there are variations. I've worked with a lot of different producers. Everybody does things differently.
Well, let's shift to a different record. So Road Ode, you had picked the live version, and there is only a live version, right? This is the version.
Yeah. I never recorded it with a band or even, you know, just me and the guitar in the studio. It was always a live version.
From 1993, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just played it in shows. I used to open the shows with that song. I think I picked that one because it has to do with what I was just saying, is that the songs are written to be performed. I've always thought of myself as a performer rather than a recording artist. So despite the fact that I've made, I don't know, 30 records or whatever it's been, I'm just a guy who's writing songs and singing them for people. And then every once in a while, we'll go on and get some microphones in front of it.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back to The Bottom Line, Loudon Wainwright. Hey! On the road again, paying my back taxes, road again. Well, you walk into the room and switch on the TV, and there's Phil Donahue or Oprah Winfrey, and suddenly you don't feel so lonely, even though you're out on the road. Open up the drawer and there's that Bible, God's honest truth, but you're not liable to use it, you prefer myth and libel. That's cause you're out on the road. It's baby shampoo, no you're not snobby, losing your toothbrush is your hobby. Lucky they sell that stuff in the lobby, lucky that you're out on the road. Out on the road, out on the road, you're Willie Loman and you're Tom Joad, Vladimir and Estragon, Kerouac, Genghis Khan. Out on the road, out on the road, keep on going, it's your creed and code. It's a different way of life, it's a whole other mode, living out on the road. Well, Well, you're packing them in, so we did okay. But the people from the record company didn't pay, so there's no percentage, though it looks that way. Math's funny when you're out on the road. It's your fault you didn't draw. There was an item in the paper that nobody saw. When business is bad, then there ought to be a law against you out on the road. There's people to avoid, places to miss. Backstage access, who needs this? The club is a toilet when you gotta take a piss. And the sink when you're out on the road. Out on the road, out on the road. You're Willie Loman and you're Tom Joe. Vladimir and Estragon, Kerouac and Genghis Khan. Out on the road, out on the road. That's where your wild oats were sowed. You start out a prince and you end up a toad. Living out on the road. Room service is a trick, rarely a treat. So you go for a bite that can't be beat. But how many patty melts can one man eat when he's eating out on the road? A cat eats a fish, dog eats a bone. Out on the road, a man eats alone. Time to reflect and to atone for his sins out on the road. Running through airports at 43's okay for OJ, but it's not for me. With a hernia, a bad back, and a bum knee, and a guitar out on the road. Out on the road, out on the road. You're Willie Loman and you're Tom Joad. Vladimir and Estragon, Kerouac, Genghis Khan. Out on the road, out on the road. The flight's been canceled, you should have known. The airport is your new abode. Living out on the road. Let's go! Folk music, you know, you can do that. When it's time to come back to reality, your road's sick and you're half crazy. So you fit right in quite naturally, home from out on the road. Back to see family and friends and to face the music and to make amends. But coming up for air, you can get the bands in from out on the road. Open that bag, go on, expose it. Open that window, hold your nose. It's 8 weeks worth of dirty clothes in from out on the road. Willie Nelson has a bus and a sound man. He can kick and cuss and a road manager to make a fuss. Willie goes out on the road. A roadie carries his guitar and in that bus is a VCR. Well, Willie deserves it. He's a big old star. Willie goes out on the road. So Willie goes out 4 weeks at a time, makes a ton of money. It's a life sublime, but for me it's punishment and crime. Why do I go out on the road? Out on the road, out on the road. I'm not Willie Nelson, I'm Tom Joad. Vladimir and Estragon, Kerouac, Genghis Khan. Out on the road, out on the road. Keep on going, it's your creed and code. But if you keep on going, you're gonna explode. Living out on the road.
Yes, it's not just a live performance. You've really captured, I assume it's sort of a little different every time you're doing these. Or are you doing this so often that every gesture is probably virtually the same every time? How loose do you feel like you get live?
Pretty loose.
One of your live albums, you put a version of Cobwebs where you actually are so slurring through the words and then you say, I forget the words as part of it. Like that, this captured a unique moment.
Yeah.
And on this one that we got the little fake start, the on the road again thing, like, would you pull out that joke repeatedly, or that's just what happened this particular night?
The Willie Nelson joke, you mean?
On the road again. Oh, yes. About paying the taxes. Yes. That's a Willie Nelson joke. Okay.
I would do that. I would do that every night because that's a joke. But my performance of the song varies a lot. It's not nailed down. I like to think that I sing the melodies pretty much as they are, but even that changes.
I'm just counting the something over a dozen verses and three choruses. So this is definitely one that if it doesn't have a lot of variation throughout, then it's going to seem like what a plodding English ballad, you know. But this is very rollicking, and you know, three verses go by super fast. And yeah, this is one where you're starting with talking about being on the road, where it is all that mundane detail, talking about the toothbrush and shampoo and things like that, the effluvia of being on the road, as I don't know, maybe to make a contrast with this interesting collection that the sense in which Willie Loman and Kerouac and Genghis Khan and Tom Joad and the Waiting for Godot characters are traveling. Do you remember like how that collection of names might have come together?
It came to me. For me, that's the mystery of it.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to put a chorus in it, and I, you know, all of those names, all those people were road warriors, or there are road references, certainly. So that was a case of plain old inspiration, that kooky, crazy thing that comes down the pike sometimes.
Well, I'm more wondering, you know, given especially the length of this, is there typically, okay, this is the rough draft, and then maybe as you play it out more, or maybe even before it gets to that point, now I've cut it down by 5 verses. Now I've crossed out these 12 lines and thought of something funnier or whatever. Like, is it all just inspired first time on the page? Your stuff seems more precise and constructed than that, but maybe you're...
Well, no, there's a kind of a burst of ideas, and then it's edited and crafted and changed. And, you know, often in a performance, I'll play it and I'll realize that something isn't working, so I'll adjust that. I mean, I mess with it, but my best songs, the meat of them, the meat on the bones anyway, it happens pretty quickly, you know, in an hour or two, generally. And then there's a whole process of editing and changing and moving things around a little bit.
And I guess the, you know, is this working? Most of your lyrics seem very much designed to say something very specific that an audience can understand, right? There's not a lot of, okay, here's a weird metaphor that could be taken 3 different ways. Here's some abstract thing. Like if it's poetic like it was in the first song, that it's at least a clear metaphor, right?
Well, clarity is, you know, my dad was a journalist, a very good, he wrote for Life magazine and he had a column in the magazine for years. And I think it's something that I got, or I've always claimed that it's something that I got from him. It's clear, it's simple, it's understandable. There's nothing cryptic about it.
Mm-hmm.
Often I use description. You know, I'll describe a picture or I'll describe a drunken night in LA in 1975. You know, it's the way that I write. And I think it has a kind of journalistic, I don't know if that bent is the right word, but I appreciate, I mean, when Bob Dylan writes a lot of his songs, you don't know what the hell he's talking about. And it still works. But I don't really write that way. He's a different kind of a songwriter than I am, I think.
Well, I don't know if this is obscurity, but it took me a minute to look at it. But this, the verse about the Bible, right? There's the Bible in the drawer, God's honest truth, but you're not liable to use it. If you prefer myth and libel, that's because you're out on the road. Whereas is the subtext, as stated, it's, I prefer myth and libel to the Bible, but is myth and libel the thing that is being contrasted, is actually stated to the Bible, but it also seems like a sort of backhand way of, yeah, of course the Bible is itself a bunch of myth and libel, or is that just something, a way of getting that sentiment in there without having to say it?
I was looking for an opportunity to use the two words that sound exactly the same, libel and libel.
Okay.
I play games with words a lot of the time in the songs too, for fun. And I think that also can engage an audience.
When business is bad, there ought to be a law against you out on the road. Is that merely, this is hard being in the circumstance and it doesn't seem worth it given the crowd? Or is it, I don't know, I've been in situations where this is so empty. Why do you even deserve to be up there? I don't know. To what extent is this sentiment self-recrimination, or is it just joking around, really?
Well, you know, I can tap into my own self-recrimination or hatred even, but... and use it, you know. I mean, I'm using all of my emotions
mm-hmm.
if I have access to them.
Do you know where this structural bit, so you got the chorus repeats, but the second half of the chorus gets to be different every time. So you've got the thing for people to recognize, but then you still get to vary it, you know, depending on how far into the song we are.
Yeah.
You have any idea where that, or is that a tool you use commonly? Is this, you know, do you even know?
I don't know. It's just, I'm just trying to make it work.
I didn't realize that OJ was before 92. I'd have to go look back at that you're referring to OJ in this song.
OJ was the guy that ran through the airport for, I guess he worked for Hertz Rent-A-Car or something, or Avis.
This is not OJ escaping in the...
No, it's way pre that.
Okay. All right. Sure.
Bronco. It's way, way pre Bronco.
Yes. It was your 2000 album that has all the social studies, that has the wash of 90s references, including that.
Yeah, that's the other OJ.
Okay. Well, it carries forward. Yeah. And so much of this, so I can see how, you know, like, where am I going to break from the thing and do a big spoken word thing? You know, I would think this is, it's like delivering a stand-up comedy act, that this just gets honed over time. Do you even recall, like, how long you'd been playing this song before this got recorded? Like, is there typically a pretty short?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I've been playing it. I knew it. I didn't have to read it or anything or remember it. I knew that it worked because I played it for audiences and they loved it and laughed and clapped. And so then one night we just got some microphones in there and got it.
And I guess I got to ask another structural thing, because this is such a long...
You're a real structural guy, aren't you?
Thing. Well, I'm just looking at the lyrics laid out before me and the fact that, you know, it's being out on the road and it sort of gets more exhausting. And then, oh, now you're home. And this weird, you know, like you're coming home from Vietnam or something, you know, how can you actually fit back in normal life? But that's not the end of the song. We're going to have the most intense part, the most fraught part, which is sort of summing up the whole thing, where everything is in one note for a while, you know, because you're building this.
Willie Nelson has a bus and a sound man. He can kick and cut, and a road manager to make a fuss when Willie goes out on the road. That's just action packed, playing around with words.
But I just
and it brings the song to some kind of a crescendo, I guess.
Yeah, as opposed to having that during when, you know, the part where you're on the road in the song and grousing about Willie Nelson. No, it ends up being sort of I've given the whole story of I'm on the road and now I'm home, but now I'm gonna, you know, sum up, because this is of course gonna be a recurring experience. This is
but don't forget that we start with the Willie Nelson joke. So why not come back and finish?
All right. I had not even made that, I was just connecting it to the, there's another song about a road. He's not top of mind enough for me in considering this. All right, I guess, and then it just goes right into the next song. You know, it seemed like this album as a whole, or at least parts of it, was like, this was the set, as opposed to we're capturing this from a bunch of different gigs, or do you even recall with that Career Moves album?
It was one night. Hmm. We did two shows at the Bottom Line. And the guy who produced it, called Jeffrey Lesser, did a masterful job of making it seem like one show. It was two shows, but it certainly wasn't more than two shows.
Oh, let me pull out one place, the particular break that you have in there.
Let's go! Folk music, you know, you can do that. When it's time to come back to reality, your roads.
So in addition to, you know, the little jokey thing that you put in there and, you know, captured this, I'm sure this is just something that happened that one time. Although I noticed you doing some retuning during songs in other live footage I was watching you. But yeah, having that and ending with this sort of suspended fourth thing that could go on any period. I mean, it really is just a purely matter of comic timing. I don't know. Is this why you're mostly just playing by yourself? Because you're able to have that flexibility and you don't have to worry about a drummer or something following you, or, you know.
What you're not getting is the sight of what I'm doing. When I'm doing that, da 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 da, I am doing basically a kind of cheesy impression of Bruce Springsteen when he would point his guitar to the crowd.
Ah,
he was a contemporary of mine and, of course, a huge star. So I was doing a Springsteen shtick, which is why I got a laugh, because the audience recognized that.
All right. Well, then I guess this interview will have added something to people's enjoyment of the song retroactively. Let's get the third song out there. You had chosen, I said, pick something from an early album. There's a Baby in the House from album 2, 1971. Why this song? What did you feel like, if this is going to represent to these new listeners your whole early catalog. Why this one in particular?
This is a song that's more than 50 years old. I still perform it. There aren't many songs that I do play from my first two albums, which were made for Atlantic Records. They were entirely acoustic. So that in itself, I think, is an indication of the strength of the song. You know, I have four kids and a couple of grandkids, and I've written about my kids. I mentioned the family. I mean, I've written songs about all of my kids. Well, this was actually written before I had any kids. So it's kind of prescient to a degree. I was staying with some people in Somerville, Massachusetts. We were all in our early 20s, and they had a new baby. That's what inspired me to write the song. But I knew then that having a baby is pretty scary. And I was right about that. I just thought that it would be, if I had to pick three songs, which is a little bit of a daunting task. There are so many fucking great songs that I have. I thought that I'd throw in kind of my first song about kids that I was written before I had any kids.
Careful, there's a baby in the house, and a baby will not be fooled. It's a thing brand new, does what it wants to until you get it schooled. Be careful, there's a baby in the house, and a baby will play for real. If your I love you is an IOU, don't expect to get a good deal. So look out, mama. Look out, Dad. Your bundle of joy will not be had if the blanket is blue or if the blanket is pink. You best watch what you do. You best watch what you think. Careful, there's a baby in the house, and a baby can spot your shtick. Well, a coochie coochie coo is a lot of poo poo when you spread it on that thick. Be careful, there's a baby in the house, and a baby is better than smart. It can waddle through all the stuff you do, never mind your big head start. Be careful, there's a baby in the house.
So I'll admit, in going through that album the first time, I sort of have this, because it's the blues song, and it's kind of slow. So like on the Bob Dylan albums, he'll have his one blues song, and I'll skip that generally. So I'm really glad that you called my attention to this, but like, oh, this is actually a really cool guitar riff. I don't know, as a guitarist, was this, you know, it starts with just this whole guitar solo progression, was this kind of a big creation for you that like you learned how to do a new thing, or you had already, this was old hat by this point?
You know, I learned how to play the guitar when I was about 15. I never was thinking about getting to be a better guitar player or to be Richard Thompson or Stevie Ray Vaughan or anything. I mean, but it's just a kind of catchy line. Da ba da 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 ba da. So, you know, that's all it really was. But be careful, there's a baby in the house, though. It also gives me an opportunity to use the Yiddish word shtick.
Aha. Uh-huh.
There's another song on album two called Nice Jewish Girls. So for a guy that's as waspy as I am, this, I think, is important to point out.
So as scary as the responsibility of a new baby is, it seems at least a novel sentiment to say the thing to be scared of is because it won't be fooled by you. What do you even remember, like, what this?
Yeah, again, it was years and years ago, but I remember, you know, looking at this little infant, his name was Ian. I now can remember his name. His father is no longer with us. I don't know about the mother, but a kid would just look up at you and no fear, no bullshit.
Or the phrase, if your I love you is an IOU, which I understand just because those sound nice together, but I was just trying to take that literally, like, I'm here, I'm doing the thing that I'm supposed to do, and I'm smiling at you, but I don't actually want to be here. So I don't know, what do you know what the sentiment was, or what does it mean to you now, given that you still play this? I saw there's a 2017 version.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the best lines in the whole damn song. If your I love you is an IOU, I mean, that's about conditions and conditional or unconditional love, which is the most important thing. I mean, that's what we grapple with for our entire lives.
Of course, there is the fatigue and the how interested can you be for so many hours and just the sheer, but for the most part, I don't know, I didn't have any, when I had, my kids were small, I don't feel like I had, like, it's almost like having pets that you just are completely unrestrained. It's only when they get older, then there's weird political dynamics in expressing affection. But the thought that there being any conditions on a 4-month-old or something, like, almost doesn't make sense to me.
Well, it's a tricky, you know, that's why it's be careful, there's a baby in the house. It's a tricky thing.
Yeah, certainly I know there are lots of parents who have some sort of fundamental, like, I know I'm supposed to love this baby, but I don't, or very difficult things to deal with. I mean, is that the kind of thing that you're referring to a little here, or this is just more universal because babies are scary and weird?
They're just open and honest. I don't know if I used the word, I mean, I guess I already did use the word scary. It's a huge job.
Yeah.
They have no power and you have so much compared to them. You have kids, so you know, it's a huge job that never ends.
Although one of the issues is not generally, and I don't want to sound like I'm picking on individual lines, this is a very fun song, but the baby not buying, I don't buy your coochie coochie coo. Is that just purely a joke, or is that an expression of some underlying tension?
Well, you know, again, I use the word honest. I mean, a little baby will look at you honestly and you can go, yeah, yeah, coochie coochie, you know, and they'll respond or not, depending on how they're feeling. They're pretty truthful in that regard.
Well, and I recall my mother-in-law talking when I had little babies around and you're like, oh, they're so intuitive. They can tell if you're fully present. I'm feeling, no, actually, it's entirely, as you say, how they're feeling at the time, not that their honesty is such that they can see through your lies and deception or something like that. I don't know. Any thoughts on the preternatural senses of children?
Oh, man. Again, I've written so many songs about kids and my kids, and there's a huge list of them, and I'm still grappling with the... I will say that being a grandfather is much easier. You know, you can hand them back. The amount of responsibility seems to me anyway to be less.
Well, and you've got all, you know, having a fairly exceptional personal life. And I will strongly recommend, I will link folks to your liner notes book. I listened to the audiobook version that is nice that when there's lyrics written on the page, you actually sing them with your guitar. Like I've read so many musician biographies And nobody seems to actually do that. They'll read as if the Richard Thompson one, for instance, you know, if there's lyrics, they will read them as if in a monotone, you know, not, I could bring other instruments.
No, that seemed to be a cool thing to do when we did the audiobook, was to actually play the songs.
In that respect, so I'd gone through your catalog and heard a song like One Year, the song about having had a baby, but not seen it for a year. Right. And not knowing the personal, I didn't know if it was a literary thing, but like that, no, this is literally a thing that happened to you, that you have such a variety of experiences with children that are not just this sort of universal, it's a big responsibility, everybody can relate to that, but this like very specific thing that happened to you.
Yeah. Well, happened to me, but not just to me. Yeah, that's a very specific song about a very specific situation. Again, the journalistic thing, I'm reporting.
Or 5 years old. I have a young child that I don't live with, having a birthday that I'm not there for. And so I'm going to do this song in lieu of that, that it's just such a...
Right. A lot of my songs about being a parent or parenthood is about being an absent parent. Wow. It's a terrible thing to be, I'll tell you. But I did it for years and years and years. I'm trying now, this late in the game, to be a little better on that stuff. My dad, who I've mentioned before, he was very absent. I mean, he could be in the room and he just wasn't there because he was fixated on his own thing. And I inherited all that from him. Thanks, Dad.
Before looking at the autobiography, I thought maybe some of this was, because that would be a brilliant literary setup, this 5 years old song, if it was not something that, you know, was actually in your life. Are there other songs in your catalog that you are more, whether it's, you know, a thing you heard about or just an imaginary, obviously you've got songs about Tonya Harding and other things, you know, but that you're more creating a narrative situation, because that's what most people, when they write, when they have a catalog as vast as yours, they run out of things in their personal life. I've long since run out of interesting things in my personal life. So, you know, they create all these characters and things that doesn't seem to be something you're too focused on.
I guess not. Although I often, you know, I'll start to write a song and I'll think, am I really going to write about this again? And the answer often is, yeah, if it's good, go ahead and write about it again.
Or just changing. Okay, so I'm not writing about the exact same situation. Let me add in some detail. I mean, I have a song called Pretty Pretty Preeta. Like, I've never dated an Indian person, but I didn't want just another song. I wanted a song with a name in it. And this just came to mind, but I could still make another thing about my wife, but yet very lightly fictionalized.
And that didn't bother your wife?
I mean, she thought it was a little questionable. I had to clarify that this is, you know, but with rock lyrics, I think it's almost, meaning is optional. Whereas your approach with folk, that is not the precedent that you've set. Your songs do not tend to, they could, as you said, you write great melodies, just hang on the melody, unless there's some things that I'm not thinking of. Are there some songs in your catalog that you feel like, oh, this is just purely a melodic exercise and is fun, but is just a jokey, you know, is a...
No, I think the songs are lyric driven. I think that's safe to say my songs are.
I mean, of course, there are jokey songs. Of course, we have Dead Skunk and things like that. Like, oh, that one's about my wife too. It's just, it's metaphorical about my, you know.
People actually used to, when that record came out in 1972 and, you know, was getting a lot of airplay in certain parts of the country anyway, I did a lot of interviews about that and journalists would say, so that song's about Richard Nixon, right?
You're so literary. This must have symbolism.
Whatever you think.
All right. From this era, maybe another way that I had been introduced to you is hearing the big star version, Alex Chilton singing Motel Blues, another song from this album by itself, which perfectly captured that sort of poignant, wounded thing that he was trying to do at that time. And it, you know, it was only later than like, oh no, this is the original. This is maybe why Alex Chilton in his later career was like, I'm not a songwriter. My famous songs are a bunch of generalities and vague images. Like, this is a real songwriter.
Well, I think he's a real songwriter.
He was very self-deprecating.
I was delighted that he recorded that song and am always delighted when anybody thinks my songs are good enough to cover.
Well, I saw a couple covers of Road Ode when I was looking around today. I don't know if you've checked them out, but you know.
I don't really do that, but that's good to hear. Were there any good ones?
Nothing that immediately blew me away.
Right.
But to transition, I guess, to the final thing, we were going to introduce. So my sort of reintroduction to you. For this podcast, I tend to try to listen to everybody's albums in order. I had actually done that to you years ago, and it was after probably through this Judd Apatow rediscovery or whatever, but Last Man on Earth, the album, I think that was the one that I got a hold of first. I don't know, that I was focused on. And I just, this opening track from it, Missing You, both in its songwriting presentation and the string arrangement, which has an awesome rhythmic, the way it matches with your vocal is very strange. Any thoughts about this one before we say so long?
Yeah, well, I want to give credit again to Dick Kennett, who did that string arrangement. That was the first time that Dick and I ever worked together. And it's a wonderful string arrangement. My favorite line in that is, my motto is, no nap, I'm crap, of course.
Yes, that you pulled that out in your audiobook as something that has a life beyond this song.
Now in my show, I sell t-shirts that say, no nap, I'm crap. Ah,
all right.
$1 million idea.
It's a very salient thing. Whenever there's a performance situation, if you can go into it fresh. Well, this was super fun. I guess, what are you working on next? It's been a little while since the last album. Is there another one that's almost in the can?
Actually, I'm working again with Dick Kennett and another friend of mine who also worked actually on Last Man on Earth, a wonderful producer and engineer called Stuart Lerman. I went to England in March and did three nights in a little club in North Kensington in London, and we're making a live record. And in fact, we have a version of Be Careful, There's a Baby in the House and a version of Missing You, turns out, on the live record.
You know, I didn't mention with Baby in the House and sort of your other stuff from that period, how, of course, how your voice is quite different at that time. Yeah, that you know, looking at this 2017 version I just found online of There's Careful, There's a Baby in the House, like, oh, okay, that's you with your mature voice, which seems to have come around in the early 80s, something like that, that like you sound recognizably like you, as opposed to this guy who it seems like you passed that voice on to Gordon Gano from the Violent Femmes. Like, that's at least what, if I had been aware of you when I first heard him, I would have been like, oh, that's...
Yeah, my voice in the beginning of my career was very high-pitched and kind of keening is the word I use. I mean, and I actually don't care for it. I mean, I think the songs are pretty good and the intensity of the performances, but I don't like the sound of my voice on my first four records, really. I like my voice better now.
Sure. Even by the Swimming song, you've entered some other, you're trying something else. You know, it's no longer that piercing thing, which I guess works great in a club. You mentioned in your book about, you know, some review saying that that tone of voice, it really would get people's attention.
Yeah.
But it hardly seems necessary given the range in something like Road Ode.
Well, I also love to be just a vocalist. I mean, I keep mentioning Dick Kennett, but Dick and I did the one Grammy that I won is a record called High, Wide and Handsome, the Charlie Poole Project. We wrote some songs for that. It's a double album. It's focused on this wonderful banjo player and singer from the 1920s, Charlie Poole from North Carolina, not so far from Asheville, North Carolina, actually. I loved that record because I sang old Charlie Poole songs. I also did another record where I sang old jazz songs, a record called I'd Rather Lead a Band that Vince Giordano was the band leader of. So I love not being a singer-songwriter and that persona that I've created of whatever that is.
No, I'm really glad you're mentioning this stuff before we're done here, just because looking at the variety of projects, that it's not just been you on the road with your solo stuff, and then every year here's another album of personal songs, and here's another album of personal songs, that there have, especially lately, been these different projects, this surviving twin one-man show, which I guess you're usually a one-man show, but like, no, this is different. Collecting all the family stuff together, like that's a very powerful thing. And these couple of things, which admittedly, as a songwriting podcast, I did not focus on for my prep, but here, but it sounded like it was super fun. The two projects you mentioned, the Charlie Poole and I'd Rather Leave a Band. Yeah. Are there other sort of scholarly things that you're investigating that, you know, we might have a Charlie Poole or, you know, some other figure?
I can't think of anybody at the moment that I'm fixating on. But yeah, you got to keep changing and trying different things. In the shows now, I also do, you've mentioned my book a few times. I actually put down the guitar and perform some of the, you know, the book is a series of essays.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you recall, but there's an essay where I imagine my own memorial service, called Memorial Service, and all the women that will be coming to my memorial service, my wives and girlfriends and everything else. Well, now I perform that. So, you know, and that's a relatively recent thing that I've started to do, where I'll there'll be a little acting performance, I guess you could say, where I will, I mean, I wrote it, but it's not a song.
Sure. And while we're on the topic, that throwing in a cappella stuff, also pretty exceptional. It almost seems like in some cases, well, okay, this is a short snippet. The song Between is one I was almost thinking of inserting here as an additional track, because that's very, you know, a very powerful little a cappella piece. But some of the others, what's the Birthday Wish one on the new album? Like, well, I could have played a guitar, but I don't know. Any thought of like when you're...
Well, again, it's like a banjo would be good, or a ukulele, or do it a cappella. You know, I came out of that folk tradition where guys would stick their fingers in their ear and be wearing Aran sweaters and singing wailing songs. You know, so that when I went to the Newport Folk Festival in 1963, I saw a lot of that. I absorbed it. I mentioned this thing we did in London. There's an a cappella version of my song Rufus is a Tit Man, which goes down a storm, as they say in England.
Well, yeah, if you got a rapt audience, you could stop and do anything. You could do, let's do a little sketch. Let's do a, you know, in one of your live albums, you're having a little conversation with one of the other guys on stage and et cetera.
Yeah, it's just 75 to 90. That's another essay in the book. That's the job, is to take 75 to 90 minutes and engage a group of people in a room and let them think about it at least until they get back to the parking lot.
And are some of those like, I'm going to read the essay by my dad about the suit or something, and it, like that kind of stuff? Or is that?
Yeah, well, my dad was a great, you know, the fact that I've nailed his ass for being a distant father. He was a great, great writer. I'm not the only guy that says that. And his essays, the one about the suit, the one about the dog, having to put the dog down, I think is, you know, I'm prejudiced, obviously, but my father's been dead since 1988. So to perform that is a wonderful experience. Unfortunately, when I did Surviving Twin, which is me doing those essays, you know, I spent months memorizing. I could not perform them now because I've forgotten them and I'd have to read them. But I loved doing that thing, that Surviving Twin thing.
You talk in your book about finding all of his old life essays and getting them. Is there any even legal way to republish? Like, this is me presenting my dad's collected works.
Well, yeah, I've talked about that with other family members. Life Magazine or Time Inc. And God knows who, you know, maybe it's Warner Brothers. I don't know who the hell owns.
Maybe no one will notice, I guess.
At this point, maybe not. I'd love to have people read those. They looked great on the page, those pieces too.
All right. Well, so glad to get this last little bit of other things you're involved in at this point. And just a pleasure getting to listen through your catalog and talking for an hour here.
All right. Well, I enjoy talking to you. Thank you very much.
He don't stay out anymore. No more coming in past four. Most nights he turns in round 10. He's way too tired to pretend. Sure, you might find him up at 3, but if he is, it's just a pee. And some nights he's awake till 2, but that's just 'cause he's missing you. He's lying there missing you. He don't sleep late anymore, up like a farmer half past 4. When that sleepy sun pops up, He's halfway through his second cup, and his day's work is done round two. That's when he starts in missing you. Quarter to three, it's time to nap. He always says, no nap, I'm crap. His motto is, no nap, I'm crap. Guess he's just set in his ways. He does the same damn things most days. And the 7/24's a week with lots of downtime, so to speak. But he hardly glances at a clock, since his routine is carved in rock. Man's a machine, what can he do? Keep going though he's missing you. Keep right on going, missing you. And his teeth fall out, so does his hair. But in his dreams, you're always there. A jewel in his unconscious mind. A miracle, a precious find. But in the end, he's all alone. He wakes up and his jewel is gone. There's a heaven and he knows it's true. But he's back on earth just missing you. And it's hell on earth just missing you. Back where he started, missing you.
Thanks so much to Loudon. A real pleasure talking to him. Learn about his work at lw3.com. It sure has been a long time since my last release. I had issues with my editor. I'm getting a new editor. In fact, if you, as a musician, have some audio software, might want to be my editor, reach out to me, mark@nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. The position is not yet finalized, though I do have some different groups working on the next couple episodes, which should be out in much shorter order than it took to get this one out. Those episodes are with Ian Matthews of Fairport Convention fame, another long-toothed acoustic singer-songwriter type, very pretty voice, and British. Then, just yesterday, I talked to Django Haskins, the songwriter for a band called The Old Ceremony, which is great. So please subscribe directly to this podcast at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com to make sure you get those episodes promptly. I would also appreciate your support. Patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. You'll get ad-free episodes and my special episode notes that give the lyrics, details on the arrangements, pretty much anything that I draw on to make comments while I'm talking to the artist. I hope you're doing well this holiday season. I have been, well, not playing with my band anymore, that kind of fell apart, but still working towards getting a recording done. Eventually, you can hear the demos to all the songs I'm going to record on my Facebook page if you want to look me up there, Mark Lintonmeyer. And in particular, I've been working on my drumming, which I think I'm going to do throughout this new album, though that is not a certainty until I start actually recording it. But I've been replacing some of my cymbals. I've been practicing. Hopefully, I will be up to the task. I've recorded my own drums on several songs in the past, but never tried to do it being the main drummer for the whole album. So I hope you are challenging yourself musically, keeping yourself busy, listening to a lot of good stuff in whatever way you can. Keep it on musicin'. Until next time, this is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.